people start getting on there.
This is an oral history with Jenny Stevens, done at her house. I'm Darlene Port, and this is for the Alaska History course, April 8th, 1995. Okay.
Okay. This is kind of funny. I guess this has to be a recent history, Darlene, because when you asked me, I thought there were many other people that would be have more Kodiak experiences, but I have a few, too.
Well, good. Well, first of all, I'd like to know when you came to Kodiak.
I arrived on December 31st, 1971.
Okay. And why did you come to Kodiak?
I was offered a teaching job, and it was considerably more money than I was offered in other positions. I'd graduated in the middle of the year, and this was a music job, and the other jobs weren't all music, and it was considerably more pay. And I wanted to come to Alaska. I had friends who had come here to teach, and so I was curious too. And I figured I could at least come for a year. If I hated it, if I had to live in a tent and it was freezing cold, and you know, all the things that people who aren't who have never been to Alaska imagine Alaska to be, I imagined all those same things, having no idea where I was going, and thought I could stick it out for 6 months, and if I hated it, I could always leave. And here I am, still.
So where was your first teaching position?
Well, I was a music teacher. It was a shared position between Peterson Elementary and Main Elementary. Peterson Elementary at that point was had just been transferred over to the Coast Guard from a naval station to the Coast Guard. So the school was pretty large at that point, over 500 kids. We had sort of people stacked in closets at that point, and I taught my band classes. That's what I did mostly, was band classes in the cafeteria. And then at Main Elementary, I taught some general music and band classes. The band classes were a riot because they were between the band room, which also had classes, band, of course, and a gymnasium, which had a class, because it was like one of those gym stage kind of deals.
Right.
So I was on the stage. Band was behind me. Band room was behind me. I was on the stage. The gym class was in front of me with a curtain between us, just the grand. And then there was another class above in a balcony kind of area where the cafeteria was for the elementary school. And there was another gym class, an elementary gym class in there. So I don't know how I did it. But I do remember at one point, it could get very frustrating because people were sharing facilities. And so sometimes... I remember one time, well, I gave my classes up a lot because there was no, you couldn't hear, or there wasn't, something else was in there, they had an assembly or something, and so sometimes I couldn't have my classes, and it was very frustrating. But I remember one time this little girl from the high school, sweet little girl, cheerleader, came down from the high school and said, "We're going to be having an assembly in half an hour. You'll need to move your class."
I said, "I am not moving my class. You can send Mr. Beiler down here, and I will tell him that I am not moving my class." And they didn't have their assembly, so.
Oh.
I was pretty new then.
Yes.
Just a baby. Getting to Kodiak was just, I had no idea where I was going. I think I'd looked it up on the map, but I don't remember doing that. I had a vague idea I was coming to an island. I didn't know what that meant either. And I'd stayed up all night packing with my dad, and we'd gotten to the Seattle airport. At that point, that time, there was a direct flight from Seattle. Western Airlines had a direct flight from Seattle once a week, which sometimes got in and sometimes didn't, of course. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to the airport just exhausted and looking out at the airplane that I was going to fly into Kodiak. I'd only been on a plane once ever before that in my life, and my father didn't even know about that. So I look out, and there's four props. And I said, "I'm going to Alaska in that?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "You're going if I have to shove you on the plane and slam the door, and I will not see you until June."
Oh, wow.
So
no chance to back out
no,
if you wanted to.
No, he was not in any way, shape, or form ready to to let me back out. I wasn't serious about backing out anyway. I was up for the adventure. Mm-hmm. I had the school district had connected me with a girl here, another teacher who needed a roommate. Oh. So she met me at the airport. I came in a miniskirt. Those were the eras of the miniskirt.
Yes.
And there was lots of snow. It was January. Mm-hmm. That was the fall. There had been the big slide there by the Sealand dock. So the road was really, at that point, only open an hour a day so people could get
back and forth.
And it didn't always coincide with the flight time, so the state transportation system had to implement a ferry system. So I came in on the airplane. Tam and her boyfriend met me at the airport. It was packed. The airport was packed to the gills because they hadn't had any flights for days. It was a very small airport. There were all the outgoing passengers for two or three flights and all the incoming passengers for Western Airlines and for another airline. I think it was Wien at that point. And your baggage, they were redoing the airport, so your baggage went on a little cart from the plane and came around to the front side of the airport and was dumped on the ground. Literally dumped on the ground.
Outside.
Mm. And at that point, there was snow on the ground. It got worse later that year when it started to turn to slush. But at that point, your stuff went in the snowbank. And then you retrieved your bags. And then we were at the wrong hour, of course, to get back across the road. So you had to wait for that time. So there was a school bus, that took you from the airport to Dead Man's Curve, and you climbed down this steep, icy road down to Gibson Cove on the bus. Wow. And then you got a ferry, which was a fishing boat, and you drove across the bay and landed at the boat harbor, which wasn't finished from the tidal wave. And then the high school band director met me there because I was the fifth music teacher. So he met me very graciously. And the first thing we did was go to the bar at the Kodiak Inn. It was New Year's Eve, right?
Oh,
it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So then we went home, I guess, and then Dennis showed up with the bags. And then it was time to go to Prosnick. And at that time, all the bars in town on New Year's Eve had hors d'oeuvres, mega hors d'oeuvres, smoked salmon, clams, just everything you could imagine. There were wonderful, wonderful, wonderful seafood. Mm-hmm. Scallops, halibut, anything you wanted, crab, king, it was the height of king crab days.
Right.
So it was just fabulous. And so we went bar hopping on New Year's Eve and went to all these different Prosniks. That was our dinner. And lots of people did it. I mean, it was a big deal. So
Social event.
And I remember I had very little money left to my name at this point because I was just like the gold miners that arrived in Haines or without a penny to their name.
Mm-hmm.
I was metaphorically very similar.
Uh-huh.
We went to The last place we went was the old Beachcombers, which was a boat that had a bar and a restaurant and like a floating, like a motel. It wasn't floating, it had been landed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a ratty old place with lots of atmosphere. It was crowded, again, very, very crowded. Wall to wall people. You couldn't stand up. We were literally shoulder to shoulder. I don't know why anybody would go there now.
Wow.
But it was quite an adventure. And we sat with a bunch of friends, mostly educational staff, teachers and stuff, and had a beer. Everybody ordered a drink, and the waitress bought it. And then it was my turn to buy, because you bought in rounds like
mm-hmm.
that. And the waitress, and she told me it was $15 for the group. Well, I think I had maybe $17 to my name.
Wow.
And I remember my jaw kind of dropped because I came from 20 cents a beer, nickel a beer on Wednesday nights or whatever it was, in college town. And she said, "Oh, you're new to Alaska, are you?" Yeah. Well, I didn't know the term fresh off the boat at that point, but that's what it was, fresh off the boat. So I had to borrow money from my roommate to pay my rent for that month. I had to pay her back, and it was wall-to-wall people. It was the days of streaking and topless dancing. So I must have been very naive, but some girl took off her top on the dance floor, and pretty soon somebody else took off their top on the dance floor. There were two or three girls dancing topless. And then there was this tall, handsome, blonde guy who asked me to dance. So I went out and danced and then came back to my group of friends. And I'm just like wide-eyed. I am just totally wide-eyed. There's no other word to describe it. Plus being really, really tired from being up the night before. It's just all sort of a blur. It's just like those dreams on TV, swirling lights and swirling colors and just this sea of people. It was so crowded and noisy and... Whoa, it's just reeling. And then, I don't know, we finally went home. I don't remember much after that, but the next day, Tam and I went to the grocery store to go shopping. And we're walking down this aisle. This has been like the third time in my life that my very young life at that point, that I'd wanted to sort of change my whole way of being, you know, just sort of make an abrupt change and be... get away from the little town where I grew up, where you all have your own little niche, you know, your own little place where pigeonhole where people put you. And this was a new place to be, and a, you know, separate from any identity I'd ever had in high school or my little hometown or college or anything, you know. So I was looking forward to that part of it, and I'm walking down the grocery aisle, and someone says to me, "Hi, Jenny." I was so angry. I was so angry.
Someone you knew.
It was the guy that had danced with me on the dance floor the night before. And I don't remember telling him my name, so he must have asked somebody. I can't imagine who he asked, except maybe someone in our party. But so I was pretty snippy with him. I wasn't at all in the mood to be recognized. And then we got around the aisle, and my roommate said, "Jenny, he's pretty cute." I said, "Oh, yeah, right." Went on my merry way. It was very cold that winter, very snowy. It was one of the, you know, you hear the old-timers talk about the bad winters. Right. Well, that was one of the bad ones. And we had, I don't know, I can remember 4 feet of snow on the ground at one point that winter. And a blizzard. I remember walking downtown with... Dennis's car was in the shop, and he needed to go pick it up on a Saturday, so we all bundled up and walked downtown. We just lived right on the hill across from the high school. And we got down there, and he checked us all for frostbite because we were walking in a blizzard. It really was a blizzard.
Wow.
And it was howling and snowing and just like the little house on the prairie.
Wow.
You know, as a new Alaskan, it was really exciting.
That's exciting. Oh, well,
and then to be checked for frostbite, I felt like I'd really arrive.
Oh.
So that was a fun time. And then, oh gosh, that first winter, all kinds of things happened. I went to Fur Rendezvous in Anchorage and visited with some friends of mine that had moved up from, that were teachers in Anchorage, and who I've never seen again, by the way, but...
Well, what was a rendezvous like?
Well, it wasn't that big a deal, actually. It was pretty, I don't know, I guess I'd have to call it sleazy at that point. That we watched a parade, and it was like people dressed in furs. I came from Daffodil Festival country, you know, and here's this parade in the middle of winter, and it's 10 degrees, and there, actually it was a little warmer. It was like 30. It was just below freezing, and... But, you know, cold, and people are out there, and they're, all their costumes are fur-trimmed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It reminded me of South Tacoma, which is like the, I don't know. It's like, I've seen them in these kinds of streets in other towns where there's cheap motels and fast food places and places where you... like mediums and, you know, just kind of a quick part of town, you know?
Right.
A real commercial kind of district. And that was my initial impression of Anchorage.
Oh, really?
Except that
every sign had Yukon this, or Cold North that, or Alaskan this, or icicle this, or some reference to the north and the cold. And that's when I really realized that I was really had the sense that I was in Alaska, that I wasn't in Kodiak. It was Kodiak, and it didn't sound like Alaska, and it certainly didn't. Well, it just, I don't know. It was when that.
Your idea of Alaska?
I guess not. It was that visit to Fur Rendezvous. While I wasn't all that impressed with Fur Rendezvous, I realized that I was polar this, you know, that I was in the cold north.
In the far north.
In the far north, yeah.
Oh.
But I was glad to come home.
Back to Kodiak.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, winter in a city can be kind of dreary sometimes, you
right.
know. It's kind of, the streets are kind of gray from the, I don't know. It was
it's
just
dirtier.
It's dirtier, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a weird feeling. I've, you know, big
right.
city and big, and not by, you know, Seattle Tacoma, but scale, but
no, but
bigger
still
than
big.
Bigger than Kodiak was at that point. There was more than one grocery store after all.
So Kodiak had just one grocery store at that time?
They had Kraft's grocery store downtown, and there was a little hole in the wall. City Market was a little hole in the wall where you only went if you were absolutely desperate.
Oh,
what else happened that winter? Grocery stores were kind of an interesting thing. You could go to the grocery store, you could have lasagna on your taste buds, and you had to have spaghetti because there were no lasagna noodles.
Oh.
You had to do all those kinds of, you know, you might have tuna noodle casserole on your mind, might not be any noodles.
I see.
You might have tuna noodle casserole with spaghetti noodles because there were no curly noodles. You know,
uh-huh,
just
right.
all those things
substitutions
that you have to make. That spring, the kids around Easter time, all the eggs got bought up, and there was a sea land strike, so there were no ships coming in. And some products were expensive to ship in, so there were several weeks there where we had no eggs and no milk. And I remember running out of toilet paper one time. There was no toilet paper.
But there should be lots of catalogs in this area.
And the things that they did ship in, there were no, they shipped in by air during that sealand strike, and so supplies ran kind of low.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of things, the shelves were getting empty. And you could go to Kraft's on Saturday and literally spend all day in the store because the lines were so long, because fishermen weren't buying to go fishing.
Wow.
For, that was the height of king crab days, and so king crab fishermen went in and bought, you know, I mean, if you've been to, I don't know, Old Crafts or Safeway, when they're buying groceries for fishing boats, you know, and there's just cart after cart after cart after cart. You could go and spend all day in Crafts because that's how long the lines were.
Wow.
You tried not to, especially if you knew there was an opening or something. You just tried not to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Try to find other times to go, yeah. But sometimes it got pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
And you drank. Fresh milk was a little harder to come by, and people, the store ran out of it. Some people often had powdered milk.
Oh.
I mean, it was sort of a staple.
Right.
Well,
as far as the school then, you came in the middle of the year to teach.
I did.
But now that you're teaching K-1 and 2, you've obviously have done other besides just the band
that you started out with. I'm not through with winter.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to remember. There was so much snow and cold that winter. They sectioned off the town, and the reservoir was frozen. So they were rationing water, and your section of town we had one day a week when you didn't have any water.
No water?
No water. So that was, I mean, I had the ultimate Alaskan experience that first winter. The other thing, that really funny thing that happened that first winter was, I got this letter addressed to Jenny, care of Kodiak Schools. Jenny, the new music teacher, care of the Kodiak Schools.
And it got to
and
you.
And it got to me. It was the funniest thing. When I came that first week, it was right after Christmas, and the post office had this big sign that said, "We don't give a damn how they do it outside." It was a very tiny post office. It was where Canna is now. Most people didn't even have boxes, have mailboxes.
there was lots and lots of general delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And you could stand in the post office for an hour at a time waiting to pick up your mail if you had a package. General delivery people stood in line easily an hour.
Wow.
But it was a social event. When you went to the post office, you knew everybody who was there. And you just visited.
Mm-hmm.
So you just stood in line next to somebody that you wanted to visit with and waited for your mail. And we all laughed about it, and we all got mad about it, but it was the way it was.
Right.
And they'd had such a, you know, Christmas mail, and it was such a mess, and they'd had bad weather, and so mail hadn't come, and people hadn't gotten their Christmas things, and, you know, worse than anything we could possibly imagine. Now they just put up that sign, "We don't give a damn how they do it outside." And so they didn't, you know, there was no checking of slips. If you knew somebody and the box was addressed to, and you knew they were your neighbor, they just hand you the box and you took the box home.
Right.
It was fun.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, my memory of it is that it was fun. I don't know that we thought it was so much fun at the time. At the time. And then I got this letter addressed to Jenny, the new music teacher, which would never happen nowadays. Yeah. And it was this guy that I'd met at the Beachcombers the first night.
Oh.
And he was taking care of Helgeson's Bear Camp in Terror Bay. And it was a winter caretaker, and he was out there all by himself. And he just wrote me this letter and said at some point he had borrowed my flute or something. So, no, I guess he was talking about it, that he'd liked in the letter. So I sent it to him in Terra Bay. I mean, I hardly knew the man.
And you sent him your flute?
I sent him my flute. I got it back, and we became romantically involved later, but that's one of the most romantic moments of my life, is getting that letter from the middle of the wilderness in the middle of the winter. It was fun.
Right.
And again, an Alaskan experience, you know.
Right. It wouldn't happen anywhere else.
No. So I finished out that year, and spring was my first experience with light, the light of Alaska, when it's light until 11 o'clock midnight, and it gets light again at 4.
Right.
And I had a friend who was working on the reservoir, the new reservoir, the road. They were building a new road to build a new reservoir out near the end of the road, which is our current water system. And so they were building that road, and his job was to maintain the equipment for the road construction crew. And so I would ride out. He didn't go to work until 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So I would ride out the road with him to the shop, and then the guys that were working the road would give me a ride as far out as the road went at that point. And I took my flute and a book and a fishing pole. I didn't know what I was doing. I walked out there a lot of times that June, and it was beautiful weather. I mean, just perfect weather. And I'd be out there by myself for hours at a time. I'd play my flute, I'd read my book, I'd fish a little. I never caught a fish, but I took a fishing pole.
Uh-huh.
And then when it started to get dim, I'd hike back in to the shop. And then Stosh and I would come to town. By this time, it's 11, 12 o'clock. We'd go to Solly's, and we'd have, which doesn't exist anymore now. It's not even Henry's anymore. It's something else. We'd have dinner, and it would be crowded. There was, you know, it was a bar restaurant kind of situation, and it'd be crowded with fishermen. And we knew all the waitresses. It was another social event, the nightlife of Kodiak, and you were perfectly safe.
Uh-huh.
We had a wonderful time. Sometimes we danced a little, sometimes we had a couple beers after dinner, and then we'd go to my place and sleep. He slept on the floor, and this is the funny part, he slept on the floor, and this went on a good portion of that summer, but I had moved out of my roommate's house, and I had rented this little house, which no longer exists, next to Griffin Memorial Hospital, which is now the Mental Health Center, which used to be the old hospitals. I've been here long enough to know all this stuff. And It was a I rented it from a Hungarian man who lived out the road. And he was kind of a funny old guy. Very old world. He didn't want me living with anybody. Only I didn't really know that. Anyway, the Russian priest who had a drinking problem lived right across the street from me.
Okay.
And he sort of kept an eye on the place. He thought, and this is what he told the landlord, that my boyfriend was living there. Well, he thought my boyfriend was Stosh, who wasn't my boyfriend at all. He was just my friend that we kind of palled around together, because Stosh had kind of the hots for this girl that worked at Sally's. Mm-hmm. And I was his companion. I was his excuse to go. And the construction crew house where he was staying was really crowded. So it was, you know, no big deal to me. We were all just, there was just a whole bunch of us that were friends. So, but my boyfriend really was on a boat. The guy from Terra Bay had gotten a fishing job. And so when he came in, he was really my boyfriend. Only Father Targonsky thought the other guy was my boyfriend and thought I was living this stuff. Anyway, that and the fact that I'd never operated an oil stove and didn't know that the soot in my house was because the fire pot had burnt out and caused a great big problem. Then ultimately he told me I had to move.
Had to move out.
And that was about the time I was leaving. I was going to go outside anyway.
Well, before that, how far was the road that you said that they took you to the end of the road?
To Pillar Creek. Well, the road this direction out towards Menashka Bay.
Okay.
The shop was just past Pillar Creek, on the hill past Pillar Creek, and that's where I got. That's where the construction crew would pick me up and haul me out in some, you know, like a jeep or something, out to the road where they were working on the. I mean, the road was still raw. And so it was just actually a little farther ways out, and the road ended. Mm-hmm. So they were still blasting and cutting the road out. So I would walk. I actually, by the end of June, was getting to the beach at the end of the road.
I see. Okay.
But they were just, you know, still working on it. It was still just like a dirt track.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it was nice, mellow June. I remember we had. Somebody brought a pile of king crab, and I ate myself sick on king crab.
On the beach, or?
Oh, we had a party, and you know, there was more than anybody could eat. We had frozen king crab. We had king crab in any way, shape, or form that you could have for days. Piles and piles and piles of king crab.
Wow.
It was wonderful.
I'll bet.
Never to be seen again.
No.
So. How far along are we?
Almost to the end of this side.
Oh, so wow. It goes fast. Okay, so then that was the first winter, and I went outside and met my roommate in Wisconsin, which was a tale in itself, getting from Washington to Wisconsin. She got me a ride on a cattle truck. That's a long, another story.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with Alaska. And we came back up the highway, and by then I was sick. I had some sort of sinus infection or something, and was violently ill, and they gave me codeine cough medicine in the Yukon where a nurse can administer it. Mm-hmm. She gave me this cough syrup, and that put me to sleep until I got to Kodiak, so I don't remember the trip.
You don't remember the trip.
I do remember peeing in the Yukon. That was one thing Alaskans were supposed to do, so I did do that, but I sure don't remember much of the rest of it. I literally woke up when the ferry arrived on the dock. And that's all.
You're in Kodiak.
Yeah, that's all I remember, except for being in the Yukon and throwing up in Dawson Creek or something like that. That's all I remember. My roommate wasn't too happy either, because she had to do all the driving. So. I don't remember the next year. I don't remember any significant things about the next year. But I guess I don't remember what year things happened in. I mean, I'm getting old. My brain's petrifying.
You still had that same position at the school the following year, the band?
Oh, it changed a little bit. I think I was at Peterson full-time. I had band and general music. Mm-hmm. Then that year and the next year. And then after that, I went into the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I started out as in third grade at Peterson and didn't know a thing about what I was doing, actually, but I had wonderful help. There was a reading teacher, Linda Haney, who really helped me start to understand what I was doing, mm-hmm. about teaching reading, which had at that point terrified me. Mm-hmm. I'd gotten my official certification from the state of Alaska to teach in the classroom, but I didn't really know what I was doing. But she was a big help. And but then there were too many kids in fourth grade, so they were too many kids at a third grade downtown, so they wanted to take the two fourth grades and put them together and make a huge class and move one of the fourth grade teachers downtown to that third grade job. But one of the fourth grade teacher they were going to move had just married a Coast Guard guy, and she didn't want to drive the road. Mm-hmm. So since I lived in town and it was the new guy on the block, so to speak, they wanted me to do it. Well, anyway, it became a long involved story about grievances and procedure and stuff like that, but I did end up going to East that year and finishing out the year with that class, and I still see those kids around town. That was the nice thing about teaching in town, was you get to see your kids grow up.
Right.
You know, so I still see those kids, and that's kind of fun, mm-hmm. to hear about them and mm-hmm. know what they're doing. And then a result of the grievance procedure was that I was transferred back to Peterson the following year then, and that's when I ended up in first grade. So, and then I did that for several years, and then I did third grade again for several years. Mm-hmm. So then I went to graduate school, and then I came back, and I was in second grade at Maine for a very short time, and then there was an opening in Larson Bay, so I went to Larson Bay for 3 years.
What was that like, teaching out there?
Well, in a way, it was a little bit like going home. I grew up in a rural area in Washington. Mm-hmm. We had an 80-acre farm, and there was no running water, you know. My parents were... So when I moved to Larson Bay, there were some of the amenities missing sometimes. At that time, there was one phone in the village, which was in the community hall. You had to sign up to use it, and sometimes you had to wait for an hour. We're back to waiting in line again. And everyone, you were in a little room, but everyone in the hall could hear you, hear your conversation. It was not private. There was RatNet. We did have RatNet at that point, so you could have TV. And public radio, KMXT, but there was no central electricity. Now they have a city power, but at that point you had your own generator. And so here I thought I was going to this quiet little village, and it was actually very noisy because everybody had their own generators going.
Oh, I see.
As soon as it got dark.
Right.
And I know people talk about the bears in Larson Bay, but I never saw one the whole 3 years I was in Larson Bay. Never saw one. People would say, well, a bear just walked through town, and I lived right on Humpy Creek. Mm-hmm. So in the fall, you'd think I'd see bears on the right. creek, but I yes. didn't. No, I never saw a bear in Larson Bay. I don't know where they were, but they weren't there when I was there. I had 23 kids, K-1-2-3. Mm-hmm. Mostly they were Native kids. There were some white kids. I guess one of the things I learned about teaching there was I really liked being a family. I liked having my kids for more than 1 year.
I see.
I liked the fact that they were all related to each other, mm-hmm. that they all knew each other, played together, you know. I liked that part. I loved the people. I really did love the people. It's hard to be a single person in the village, I think, especially when you're as a teacher, it's hard to be a single teacher. There's just things you can't do, you know, and it's not private.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly relished the 3 years I was there, and people talk about how there's no culture left, none of their culture left, but I think it's very much alive. I had friends that lived in Leavelock, and they would fly over every once in a while, because it's a straight shot across the Shelikof.
Mm-hmm.
And we would compare notes about Banya customs, or stories about different things, you know, or customs, or fixing seafood, or drying fish, or it was interesting to hear the language, or what word they use. They have these little things that they swat themselves with in the banya, in the steam bath.
Right.
And the word was very similar. It was just a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Or fried bread, you know, which is called one thing in one place and another thing in another place, but close enough that you can see the, it's very much alive. You just have to be part of the family. There's all kinds of little rituals that people do because it's become custom in the place that they live in.
Mm-hmm.
And that custom comes out of their culture. I think it's very much alive. It takes a little while to ferret it out, but it's there.
Right.
And I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready to come back when I left. So then I had been there actually about 10 years before I went to teach there.
Oh.
I had visited a fish site of a friend of mine, mm-hmm. which was outside of Uyak Bay, around the corner, down by Rocky Point. The first summer I'd gone there to visit him at his fish site, he had two boys that came to stay with him at fish camp and a crewman, and I just went out to see what a gillnet site was like. Mm-hmm. It was this big, long beach, just beautiful, and razor clams that looked, you know, on the lowest tides of the year. One of the few places on Kodiak you can get razor clams. And just treeless, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That area is treeless. It's just grass and alders and willows.
Mm-hmm.
It looks very much like a California beach, except that it's colder.
Right.
You know. And cabin was very primitive. It was like camping out. And
uh-huh.
Again, not far off of what I grew up with, you know.
Right.
In lots of ways, the first time and the second time were very much like coming home.
Mm-hmm.
eating off the land, you know, eating fish and getting clams. I'd done all that as a kid, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, deer, hunting deer and all that stuff. and learning sort of to make do with what you have because you can't get to the store.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That same sort of mental set.
Mm-hmm.
And conserving fuel and conserving, because you don't know when you're going to be able to get the next supply, you know?
Right.
So then the second year, that next summer then, I asked Dennis if I could go out there and stay by myself before he came.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I flew into Larson Bay. I found a villager that would take me out to 7 Mile Beach, and they dropped me off halfway down the beach, and I hauled my things down the beach on my back. I mean, it took me two or three trips, and it was about a mile and a half to hike on cobblestone kind of beach. It wasn't a sandy beach, or, you know, it was
mm-hmm.
not the pleasantest place in the world to hike. I didn't know. I had gotten a gun, a .30-06, and a friend had taught me how to shoot it. I didn't know a thing about bears, so I was a little scared.
Yes.
You know, but nothing risked, nothing gained.
Right.
So I went for it, and it was really interesting to go do that by yourself without any other human,
mm-hmm.
and to not have radio contact, and not, to just really be by yourself in the wilderness. It was a very powerful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, the things that go through your head and how long they go through your head. At first, I was scared of bears, certainly, and very alert.
you know.
Right.
I don't think the alertness ever went away.
Right.
sort of planning what you would do if this event happened or that event happened or if the bear came this way on the beach or, you know, there was a steep cliff face, so it was just the beach and the water and the bear and me if I saw one.
Wow.
So I had to think about those things and where to shoot the darn bear if I had to, which I didn't want to do.
Right.
What if I ran out of food? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought of was the beach at the top of the beach was filled with driftwood, which was a wonderful place to explore, and which I did for a time. And I'm not the most coordinated person in the world, so I realized that if I fell and broke my leg, I was in a world of hurt for
yeah.
fooling around, you know, for just playing. And so I finally quit exploring the beechwood
right.
pile until someone got out there
right.
in case I fell and hurt myself. It seems kind of silly now, but I did. I knew I was, if I slipped and fell walking on a log, that I could really be in trouble.
Right.
And how far could I crawl with a broken leg? I don't know. All these things went through my head. There were river otters that lived in the creek.
Yes.
So it was fun to watch them. They'd come up and talk to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you could hear them splashing and playing and making noise. Uh-huh. They're not too terribly afraid of people.
Mm-hmm.
Eagles, certainly.
Of
but
course.
One of the biggest sounds, a couple things. One morning I woke up and my head was throbbing. Why do I have this headache, you know? And then I realized it wasn't me. That there was this thrumming, this horrible noise coming from the beach. And the cabin was down behind the beechwood pile. You couldn't actually see the beach from the cabin. So I walked down the trail to the head of the beach wondering, what in the world? Well, there was a storm coming and it was the surf on the beach.
Wow.
Just crashing against the beach.
Wow.
It was just pounding. It was incredible. Just like a bass drum timpani, you know?
Uh-huh.
Just howling. And we did get a rainstorm, you know, a big storm, but that was how I knew the storm was coming. It was really nasty out there.
Wow.
Just big rollers. Just huge. Just like Hawaii, you know? People could have surfed.
Wow.
The other thing that I learned about, and when you face being alone in the wilderness, there's a little bird. It's and now I know it's the golden crown sparrow, but it makes this, it goes do-do-do-do, especially in June when they're mating and nesting. And that area is just like paradise to that bird. And so there's many, 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 many of them, and they do it from probably as soon as it gets daylight at that in that area, you know, where there's no lights, no electric lights or anything. It gets light at least by 3.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes even a little earlier. So they would go from about 2:30 in the morning all day until about 12:30 at night. So there was really very little time that you were not bombarded with this bird. And that's just, I just remember thinking, gosh, would you guys just shut up? And you start, sometimes you even talk to yourself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I read constantly, which was one of the reasons I went out there, was to read. Did a little sewing. I'd taken some hand sewing along.
How long were you out there?
I was out there about 2.5 weeks by myself.
Oh, okay. And no bear encounters at all?
No bear encounters. Never saw one.
Other animals, but no bears.
Not
a relief, I suppose.
I also wondered what would happen if I had this little fantasy about if a boat went by on a storm, like that storm came up, and I thought, gosh, what if a boat was out there on Rocky Point and floundered, you know, got caught, hit the reef, and is there any way I could help people who were, you know, of course there wasn't, but, you know.
Yes.
Did I have enough food to feed everybody when they came in? And what about hypothermia and, you know, the whole
right.
nine yards? It was amazing what all goes through your head. Or what would I do if some fisherman saw the smoke from the wood fire, for instance, and came in to investigate, and here's a single woman, and, you know, weirder things have happened in the wilderness. It was, that was just, you get kind of paranoid after a while. And in some ways, part of you gets just a little bit weird being by yourself like that.
Did you stay then after the rest of the people
while.
Arrived?
Yeah, I did. I did. I came, sort of came back to normal. It was a really good experience. And then I think I got a fishing job that summer. I think that was the summer I got a fishing job.
On
a
boat?
Seiner. Oh. Yeah. An old Aleut guy.
Uh-huh.
And I was the only woman, and I was the first woman he'd ever had as crew. And that was an experience. Seining is, I think, the most romantic kind of fishery there is. Because you see, well, I did everything that you could do in the salmon fishing industry that summer. We fished the capes, we fished inside the bays, we fished Mush Bay, which has a huge school of fish, and fishing boats fighting over the tide change to get the flood of fish coming in, you know. We went across the Shelikof Straits to the other side and fished over there. I saw whales, and I saw porpoises, and I saw tons of fish, and I brailed fish, and I saw wet dry sets with no fish, and I saw phosphorus in the water at night as you're plowing through the water. And so I really had, we were on an old wooden boat that leaked, so maintaining a vessel, you know. Going to the cannery at Uganic and getting ice cream. They had a soft ice cream machine, and it was like ambrosia.
Oh, I bet.
When you've been on a boat for weeks and you get sea legs, and then you get on land and you can hardly walk. And then you get, you know, if you're on the land for a while and you get back on the boat and you have to get your sea legs again, seasickness.
Uh-huh.
I certainly had my bout with seasickness. The skipper got sick, and I had to take the boat to Port Lions by myself and land it and get him to the doctor.
Wow.
I mean, I did everything that it's possible. Stinked like a fish, you know. Those old wooden boats that leak. This was before the days of icing fish and before the days of tanking down and running chilled water tanks.
Uh-huh.
And so the fish just laid in the bottom of the boat, and sometimes they're a little ripe when you got them to deliver.
Ooh.
And then all that gurry goes down into the bottom of your boat, and you can't pop the bilge out entirely ever. So you have to put bleach in the bilge, and by the end of the summer, fish gurry is pretty rank. That little bit that's always in the bottom, in the very bottom underneath the hold. So, and what you smell like when you get off a fishing boat.
Well, what made you decide to go out and do fishing for a summer?
Oh, how could you live in Kodiak and not go fishing?
Not go fishing.
I just can't imagine anybody would do that, not go fishing. That's what Kodiak's about, is fishing of one kind or another. So, I wanted to go.
You did.
And at that time, women on a boat were bad luck, and, you know.
Then what made him decide to take you on?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
You approached him and said, I want to go fishing, and he said, okay, let's go.
No, I got a message delivered to the cannery, which got delivered to me at on the tender at Dennis's fish camp, that said Bill needed a crew. Did I want to cook?
Oh, so you went on as cook.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that isn't your only job when you're on a salmon boat. You know, in my case, I plunged on the deck. You know, when you're set, you plunge. You know, you just put this plunger in the water to scare the fish into the net, or not let them through the hole between the boat and the net. So you have other, and you have cleanup duties, and you have duties for pitching fish, you know.
Right.
All the cook's job means is that you have extra work. That's all that means.
You have to have food on the table,
yes,
too.
Yes, you have to have food on the table, too. So, I mean, I was young and healthy and strong and could certainly do it,
uh-huh.
You know, and there's lots of women in the fishery now, and there were a few women then. There were even, Mary Jacobs had her boat. She was fishing, and she had an all-woman crew. So it wasn't a
total novelty.
It wasn't a total. And there'd been lots of families who'd fished, you know, where Reimnitz's had the whole family on the boat as crew, and Oliver and Eva had crewed together for years. So women were not strangers to fisheries. Just women who weren't married were strangers to fisheries. So I had a wonderful experience salmon seining. I thought it's hard work. It's long hours sometimes. It's hot tempers sometimes. But it was very romantic. You see the sunrise, you see the sunset. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're fishing in rough weather. We did that too, where I was scared.
Yeah.
We got web in the wheel, and I mean, everything that could happen to a salmon fisherman happened that summer. Everything. There isn't a thing that didn't. I got to see a lot of country, from the south end of the island to the north end, to Mafognak, to the other side, Cape Igvec, and it was wonderful. I got to see old time kinds of fishing that don't even exist anymore. And I got to see people who were more modern and updated in their approach to fisheries. So I was right on the hinge of change.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
So when I fished, you know, I was on, like I said, on an old wooden boat, and most of those are gone now. You know, most boats are now fiberglass or steel. Mm-hmm. So I feel really enriched to have had, and lucky to have had that experience. The skipper was like an Aleut from, he had been born and raised on a Fognik. So he had lots of stories too. He used to talk about an Olak.
Olak?
An Olak. It's like our version, an Aleut version of the abominable snowman.
Oh.
He used to talk about how Olaks were people who committed crimes in a village were charged by the village elders either to be killed by the village elders or given the option of being sent into the wilderness with no tools and no clothing.
Ooh.
So people who chose that route then grew hair, grew larger, and then they were the Olaks, the sort of phantom of. But they were not bad. Part of their recompense for their crime was to help people. People mostly stayed out of their way because they were kind of like mysterious too. But Bill talked about when he was a little boy, they had rowed in a big boat to big rowboat, you know, a big boat to Yuzinki for winter for supplies. But they didn't get very far before there was a storm, and they couldn't. They were having trouble getting the boat beached in the surf.
Uh-huh.
to spend the night on the beach. And an Olak came down out of the hills and picked up the boat and turned it over on the beach so they'd have shelter. And the next morning when they woke up, it came down again and put it back in the water. And they finished their journey.
Wow.
So, I mean, he had stories like that.
Right.
He talked about going hunting with his father and leaving, it was the custom to leave gifts of little tobacco or some little tidbit of civilization for the Olak in outlying hunting cabins. And then there were stories where people would go back to those hunting cabins and they would find a little reed cross that the Olak had made.
Oh, and so, left for them.
In
exchange.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, see what I mean, how
right.
rich it was?
Right. Yes.
So, and then in some ways my going back to Larsen Bay to teach gelled a lot of those things, of stories of Bill's and my experience at the fish site being by myself, and my own background as a child in a rural setting. You can see why it was like coming home.
Right. Right.
So
So after that, well, you came back, you had spent 3 years, and then you came back here to town to teach?
Mm-hmm. What have I done since then? Well, recovering from a relationship, a dissolved relationship, and decided I needed to do something that involved people, especially after living in Larson Bay. Uh-huh. And so I kind of went, I went to a concert at the community, I went to a concert at the, well, I can't even remember, I guess I was at the college, and it, a young man had started a community choir, and it sounded good, it had a little orchestra, it sounded really good, and I thought I'd like to participate. And I knew someone in the choir, so she told me to come when they started up again at such and such a time. So I went, and I tried to sort of hide my light under a little bushel basket because I didn't really want to be involved on the executive level. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't long before someone can figure out you can read music, you can sing, you know,
right.
Da-da-da-da-da. So, so then I got to know the person that was directing pretty well, and got involved in that part of the process in a not very short time. His roommate was this little short guy from North Carolina, kind of older, a little older than me, and I thought he didn't like me. We used to go have pizza after rehearsal or something, and I thought that this person didn't like me very much. I couldn't figure it out. Well, when Bruce left town and I inherited the orchestra and the choir, Joe called me every night for a week. And I started going to the radio station to do a classical show with him. So that's how I met my husband.
I see.
So there it goes, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I'd kind of taken a break from the arts and music after college.
Uh-huh.
You know, after I stopped teaching music, I didn't do much until I got involved with community choir and orchestra. And then after that first fall, when I... Well, I don't even remember exactly the sequence of events, but I remember Jerry saying to me something about, did you like the sound of music? I say, oh, I love the sound of music. And he said, good, then you won't mind doing the vocal work for, directing the vocal work for the Sound of Music. And that was the beginning of my involvement with Jerry Wilson and the Arts Council and community choir and community orchestra and
all of that.
That was about 8 years ago, 9 years ago. So then that became another section of my life.
Right. Right.
So that's where I am now.
That's where you are today.
Yep. Who would have known?
I think it's all very interesting myself.
Then I didn't tell you about Whale Island. That was another whole...
Whale
Island, uh-huh. When I went to live at Whale Island for 2 summers in a row and take care of their house and garden while they went fishing. Oliver and Eva Holm have a homestead on Whale Island, and after my hermit experience at Seven Mile Beach, then I wanted more.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So for 2 summers, then I went to Whale Island and took care of Whale Island. They had a barge, like a little house on a raft kind of thing that they had moved onto land. That was their first little house, and I lived in that the first summer. The second summer, they built this big log house out of spruce, and they'd moved into that, and so that's where I stayed the second summer. Uh-huh. And I did have radio contact there with, I could talk to Anton Larson, I could talk to Raspberry Straits, and there was an old guy that lived in Raspberry Straits that I checked in with every day from Raspberry Straits, but one of the... You can, like I said, you get weird when you're there all by yourself. I remember Molly McIntosh and her husband and their kids and their weird dog Winston pulling up inside the bay, and I hadn't seen people for about a month. I hadn't seen anyone. And they get out of the boat, and I'm so excited. I can't talk, and my knees are shaking.
Oh, no.
Because I haven't seen a human being.
In a month.
It was so weird.
Wow.
I didn't know what to say to them. I literally could not talk. I can understand now why when people go to
visit somebody that's been in a remote area, that person seems ungracious.
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes you just don't even know what to say to somebody.
Right.
Language is almost, it's kind of gone.
Right.
And I had regular that was with radio contact with somebody. Imagine when somebody doesn't have radio
even
contact.
That much.
You sort of lose communication skills.
I suppose.
You're just overwhelmed. Overwhelmed. And then coming back to town, one summer I came back to town with Oliver. I'd been at Whale Island. I needed to come back to town, but we'd gone on a fishing expedition, subsistence fishing expedition, first. And so we'd gotten all these fish, and so we came to town, and I was going to, I was helping him process them. We were almost done. We'd gotten like 50 salmon or something, a lot of fish. And it was just Oliver and me. Even the kids hadn't come to town, and his parents were gone. We were at his parents' house. We were almost done processing his fish and getting them ready to freeze, and my hands were just frozen. I said something about, ooh, I'm glad it's almost over. My hands are so cold. And he said, turn on the warm water. Well, I'd forgotten there was such a thing as running warm water. And then the phone rang. And I answered the phone and I said, KRG 4909, which was the call sign for the CV. And then I said, ooh, I can't see in here. And he said, turn on the lights.
Forgot about electricity.
I forgot about electricity. So... Like I said, you can get pretty weird out there.
Yes, it doesn't take long either, does
it? No, it doesn't.
Uh-uh.
But I did lots of reading, and I had like some sewing projects. Mostly I read. I worked in Eva's garden a little.
Uh-huh.
I had a little boat so I could kind of punt around the outside beaches. There were two outside beaches outside this little cove, so I would either walk out to the beach or take the dog in the little dinghy and go out to the beach, and sometimes you could see boats going by, and I'd wonder about humanity out there.
What they were doing.
And you listen to the radio, and you try to solve the world's problems, and I did a little writing. So, I guess I really found those times to be growth times for myself.
Right.
So, they were real important for me to do. I liked them. And I'd always wanted to go to a remote, like, lighthouse site or a cannery, be a cannery caretaker. So this was sort of my way of
doing
that, yeah.
Right. And it was the whole summer, just the month, or?
No, it was probably the second week in June until the second week in August.
Okay.
It was about 8 weeks.
A couple of months.
Uh-huh.
Sounds good. Well, I want to say thank you very much for doing
You're
this
welcome.
Because it was very interesting.